From Public Radio International, this is The World. A co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston.
It's Thursday, July 7th. I'm Marco Werman. The newspaper at the center of Britain's phone hacking scandal says it's shutting down. We'll hear reaction from one man on the tabloid's target list, the father of a man killed in a terrorist bombing. Also, drought and famine return to East Africa. Thousands are seeking food and shelter at refugee camps.
At one of the camps, I saw a woman who had a child who had died on her back, and she didn't know. She was still queuing to get registered at the refugee camp.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, celebrating the selection of Dr. Dini Zolnaun from the University of North Carolina as the 2011 Society for Women's Health Research Medtronic Prize recipient. More about her contribution to women's health and her work in gynecological pain at swhr.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The scandal-racked British tabloid News of the World is shutting down. The London-based paper says it will publish its last edition on Sunday. The News of the World is part of Rupert Murdoch's media empire, and it ran into a world of trouble over accusations that it hacked the mobile phones of everyone from celebrities to murder victims to get material for its stories. Graham Foulkes' son was killed in the July 7th, 2005 terrorist attacks in London. Graham Foulkes, what's your reaction to the news that News of the World is closing?
I'm absolutely delighted. And I say that because Rupert Murdoch is a cold and hard man. The only language that he speaks is cash. And this will affect him enormously. And I think the man deserves every ounce of pain that this will cost him.
Tell us how you found out initially that your phone may have been hacked.
The London Police Force have a special task group who have been looking into this for a few years, and one of the senior officers phoned me and told me that News International, News of the World, had a file with my name on it. It had my personal details of phone numbers, home address, and some of those phone numbers are what we in the UK call X directory, which means they're not in the public domain. In 2005, we gave those details to the police when David was missing and we were looking for him. And it transpires that some serving police officers sold that information to the newspaper.
How do you feel about a public inquiry that the Prime Minister is now calling for?
A public inquiry is needed urgently. It's acknowledged now that the police are involved and they've been accepting bribes and corruption, then we need a public inquiry to root that out, find the officers concerned and prosecute them.
I'm certain it's terribly painful to be reminded of the period of time following your son's death. What is your view on what should happen if, in fact, it's proven that the News of the World was listening to your phone conversations?
The thought that at the most difficult and darkest time of my life, when I was having deeply personal and intimate phone calls with family and friends who were supporting us and we were trying to find David, being listened to by a journalist simply to try and get a cheap story is just the most wicked thing imaginable.
I'm curious to know, I mean, it's clear how you feel about News of the World, but I'm curious to know, Mr. Foulkes, whether you read the News of the World before this phone hacking story came to light, and how this makes you feel generally now about this culture of tabloid newspapers in Britain.
As it happens, I've never read the News of the World. I think that in any free society, the media play a pivotal and important role. And I think that the actions of this one rogue outfit should not be allowed to taint the good work of the other newspapers. It's important that we have a free and honest and trustworthy media.
Today is the anniversary of 7/7 in London, the day of those terrible attacks. I suppose the news about the News of the World today comes to you as some small kind of comfort.
I appreciate what you're saying. I am somewhat cynical about the timing of Murdoch's announcement. It's deflected attention away from his bigger empire, and if he thinks this is the way to either lose less or make more, he would have no shame about the timing of this announcement.
Mr. Folks, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Can I just say that I'm very aware that this September is the 10th anniversary of your own terrible day, and we'll be thinking of you.
Thank you very much for saying that, sir.
Thank you very much.
Graham Folks' son was killed in the terrorist attacks in London on July 7th, 2005. Bob Steele is a Nelson Poynter Scholar for Journalism Values at the Poynter Institute in Florida. Bob, the phone hacking activities of the News of the World has raised a scandal in the UK, but could the same kind of hacking happen here in the US? Does it ever happen?
Well, I think this could probably happen anywhere in the world in this day and age where you have lots of individuals who are on the edge when it comes to journalism in their techniques and styles. That said, I think it's very unlikely that any reputable news organization in the United States would use this kind of phone hacking in this day and age to do investigations. We had one incident along these lines a decade or so ago with the Cincinnati Enquirer when it was investigating the Chiquita Corporation, and one of the investigative reporters actually tapped into the voicemail system of some executives at Chiquita. It significantly undermined the reporting on that particular story, and the Cincinnati Enquirer and its parent corporation, Gannett, ended up apologizing to Chiquita and paying a large amount of money to Chiquita in that particular situation.
Well, that's one case. But generally, what are the legal constraints on this kind of phone hacking in the U.S.? Is hacking into private phones ever allowed under the law?
Well, I'm a journalism ethicist, not a lawyer, so I can't speak to the specificity of the law in this particular regard. I do know that it is landmine territory, however, and any journalist who would try to use phone hacking would very likely be running afoul of the law.
Are there cases when the issues are not so clear-cut, times when it can seem like using these kinds of methods might actually be justified?
Well, from a journalism ethics standpoint, the primary obligation of journalists is to pursue the truth in significant, important, meaningful stories. That's a very important threshold right at the beginning. The stories have to be of profound importance. So could there be a case, for instance, if journalists, through considerable investigation by other means, believe that there was corruption at the highest levels of government, and the only way to prove that corruption was some sort of surreptitious recording, that might be, in a very rare instance, ethically justified. Could you also do phone hacking in that kind of situation? I think that that is probably at the very height of the threshold, and I would think that you would run the risk of being illegal in the action that you took in order to try and prove your ethical point. And I think the risk would outweigh the benefit in that particular situation.
Bob, having led many ethics sessions for news organizations and journalists, how often does an issue like this one come up?
Well, one of this magnitude would not come up very often. It would be very rare. But I get a handful of calls every year still from reporters or investigative producers or broadcast news executives who ask questions about whether some form of surreptitious reporting is justified in a particular case. In other words, to lie to get to the truth. I very seldom had calls about hacking into a voicemail system. I think maybe I've had one or two calls over the last 25 years of somebody who was considering that, and I urged them to back away very quickly from that particular approach, to certainly get very sound legal advice, and I would question the ethical standards of which they were considering using to hack into a system. So this would be very rare here in the United States. In other countries around the world where journalists are facing an authoritarian regime, you might find journalists who are using lots of means, including perhaps some illegal means by our standards, to get to the truth.
Bob Steele teaches journalism values at the Poynter Institute in Florida. He's also a distinguished professor of journalism ethics at DePaul University in Indiana. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You can get the latest on Britain's evolving phone hacking scandal, including video and analysis from our partners at the BBC. They're at bbc.com/news. The Himalayan nation of Bhutan is known for its breathtaking natural beauty and for measuring its people's gross national happiness. That's not to say Bhutan doesn't value economic growth, too, and for that it needs energy, both for domestic use and for export to its energy-hungry neighbor, India. That's where hydropower and climate change come in. The World's Mary Kay Magstad visited Bhutan and sent us this report.
Bhutan has never been short of this. Mountain streams, rivers cascading down from snow-packed glaciers high in the Himalayas. Until recently, Bhutanese were content to enjoy the view, use a little water for crops, and a little bit more for hydropower for local use. But lately, Bhutan has been getting more ambitious about the prospect of harnessing and selling its hydropower. Yeshi Wangdi is Director General of Bhutan's Department of Energy. He says even now, selling hydropower to neighboring India makes up half of the government's gross revenue.
So it promises us this potential of making the country self-reliant. So that is the mainstay, you know, of our economy. The earlier we develop the hydropower, the better it is for the country.
Bhutan's own energy needs have more than doubled in the past decade, but it's still producing six times more hydropower than it needs. The plan now is to expand hydropower capacity even more, almost eight times more in the next decade, for export to India. The reason is Bhutan is dependent on foreign aid. It wants to become self-sufficient, and it sees hydropower as its strongest card to play. Signs of climate change are adding to the sense of urgency, says Yeshi Wangdi.
And that's one reason why the government has felt the urgency to develop the hydropower projects before the waters all become dry. And we expect that to happen in about, say, 50, 60 years' time. So before that, if we can have all these projects, at least they would have earned all the returns.
And with the returns, Bhutan hopes to build up other sectors of its economy, says Prime Minister Jigme Tinley.
We hope to be able to become a destination for world-class education, as also for health services. Then we have already begun to promote Bhutan as an IT-enabled knowledge society.
Bhutan is already on a fast track to modernization. Its capital, Thimphu, still feels like a big small town with low-slung buildings and many locals in traditional garb. But since internet and television arrived in Bhutan a dozen years ago, a generation has grown up plugged in. Remote villages have been connected by roads and electricity and mobile phones. And ever more young people are coming to the cities to be educated and find jobs. The government's hope is to provide at least some of those jobs through hydropower. But the climate is already changing in ways that could affect the supply. Sanam Yangle is Bhutan's Director General of Mines and Geology. He says his teams working in the mountains are seeing some glaciers retreat as much as 100 feet a year.
At this rate, we do realize that if the climate change is not contained at a certain point, the countries like ours, where economy is dependent on hydropower, are going to be very, very badly affected.
And it's not just receding glaciers that could affect hydropower potential. Arun Bhakta Shrestha is a climate change specialist at the International Center for Integrated Mountain Development in Kathmandu.
Along with glacial change, also snowfall change will happen. You know, very much suggested that precipitation would be more liquid than solid. So that means the storage will not be there.
That is, snow stores water and releases it when it melts. If there's less snow and more rain, there's less chance to store water for later use. So what's an aspiring modern economy to do if it wants to develop but also wants to protect its environment along the way? Preserving uphill forests and wetlands can help store water for future use. So can building reservoirs, as Bhutan plans to do. But those come at an environmental cost, even when some of the river is allowed to continue to flow freely, says Karma Chopel, Water Resources Coordinator for Bhutan's National Environment Commission.
They will definitely have impacts on the biodiversity, on the natural river ecosystems. So that is where our challenge is.
That's where one of Bhutan's challenges is. The bigger one is its leaders' ambition to modernize, urbanize, educate its population, and transform its economy, all while racing against time and climate change. At least they know they're in the race. For The World, I'm Mary Kay Magstead, Thimphu, Bhutan.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, leveraging products, people, partnerships, and philanthropy to help change the way the world addresses the global epidemic of chronic diseases such as diabetes and heart disease. More about Medtronic's chronic disease commitment at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. India is the world's most populous democracy, something to boast about. But many Indians are less proud of another side to the country, rampant corruption. And it's a problem that stretches across all levels of Indian society. There's evidence, though, that some Indians have had enough. The World's Alex Galifant reports from Bangalore.
Over the last year or so, news channels in India have been filled with talk of officials on the take.
It seems like we're living in a scam raj, whether it's the Adarsh Housing Society scam, whether it's the
Brewing 2G scam that tonight threatens to be actually bigger than the first.
Finally, the Commonwealth Games 2010 for conspiracy to cause favor to a private firm based in Switzerland.
3 months ago, those multi-million dollar scandals persuaded a 72-year-old social activist called Anna Hazare to begin a Gandhi-like fast in protest. He wanted the Indian government to write new anti-corruption legislation. It worked, kind of. Hazare's fast was highly publicized, and after 4 days, the government agreed to come up with something. The arguing over what that thing should actually be is still going on. But during those 4 days, thousands of Indians voiced their support for Hazare's cause, especially online.
A 72-year-old Gandhian, now trending worldwide on Twitter. He struck a chord with youngsters a quarter his age.
Some saw it as a kind of citizen awakening. Others, not so much.
I saw people tweeting, you know, we are with you. Anna Hazare, we are with you. But my question is, what do you support? How do you support? How do you support Anna Hazare? Just by saying it?
This is Aditya Kumar, a 29-year-old software engineer based in Bangalore. He also writes a blog about life in India.
Now, my point is this. If you have ever paid a bribe to a cop on a red signal, I don't think you are entitled to complain about corruption in India.
And that kind of means no one can really complain, says Kumar. That 100-rupee, 2-buck bribe to the traffic cop is normal. Every day. No one thinks of it as a crime, really. And the cops are hardly well paid.
Nobody wants to break the law. It's not that, you know, I have woken up in the morning and I want to break a law today. It's not like that.
It's more that India's bureaucracy is too intimidating. If you want to pay a fine the correct way, you have to claw your way through a thicket of red tape.
So what would I rather do? This is what a typical urban youth would think. I would rather pay the same amount to the traffic cop, and this way I can be let off in 60 seconds. So that's the most common thing. Then anything that involves government, anything that involves me standing in a queue and filling a form and then getting a signature from somebody up there.
Say, somebody up there who can sign off on your marriage certificate, or get your kid a place at school, or even release your loved one's body to you from the local morgue. This is retail corruption. You want it, you pay for it.
It's such a pain for everybody.
But for Aditya Kumar and others, it's also a matter of simple accountability, whether you're an everyday citizen or a powerful government minister. Over tea, I asked the historian Ramachandra Guha whether India had always experienced this level of corruption, at least in politics. He said no, not in the days of Gandhi and Nehru.
What was common to Gandhi and Nehru and that entire generation of Indian politicians was that they were personally honest. They were incorruptible in a financial sense. However, over the last 20 or 25 years, there's been a deep nexus between big business and politics, and certain kinds of big business, real estate, mining, telecom, defense contractors. These are the people who depend on state patronage to promote their businesses, and in exchange, give kickbacks to ministers. And the scale of the kickbacks is what is humongous, you know, billions of dollars.
In other words, much of Indian politics has become transactional. You want something done, you strike a deal for whatever it's worth to you. Everyday bribes are no different. They're just smaller deals. But the current outrage, especially in the media, is directed at corruption with a big C, at those big government scandals. For Aditya Kumar, outrage alone isn't enough.
The government of India, the government of the state, the government of anywhere is actually us.
And this is the idea that's been missing, he says, that by tolerating the world of everyday bribes, Indian citizens are in a way complicit in the bigger scams and scandals.
We used to take the British on the palanquins on our shoulders earlier, now we're taking our government.
Swati Ramanathan is one of the co-founders of a civil society group based in Bangalore.
We've still not made that transition in our mindsets to say that we are their bosses, and ultimately we are the ones who actually put the government where they are.
Ramanathan's group is called Janagraha, which translates as the moral force of people. A few years back, she and her colleagues asked themselves some questions about corruption.
What is even the size of corruption? What if we gave people a way by which they could report the kinds of bribes that they were having to pay?
The result is a website called I Paid a Bribe. It invites people to submit anonymously their own experiences of corruption.
And you click on that and you have over 10,000 people who have reported that this is what I paid, this is where I paid, this is the department I paid it to, and this is what I paid for, and this is how much I paid.
One person reports paying 200 rupees in Chandigarh to get a death certificate for their relative. Another says it took an extra 60 bucks to get their passport renewed in Hyderabad. And in Bangalore, someone paid 20,000 rupees to register a property, a bribe of $450, and they go much higher than that. In all, I Paid a Bribe has collected over 12,000 such reports. The vast majority tell of bribes paid. A few reveal spots of honesty in the system, and some are by people who actively refuse to pay a bribe. The site joins them all together, and it's produced a wealth of crowdsourced advice on how to deal with corrupt officials, like demanding that everything always be put in writing.
It's just if you're surrounded by an entire environment which is corrupt, it's very difficult to stay honest.
The website can help people do that, says Swati Ramanathan. But it's only part of the plan. The I Paid a Bribe team is able to extrapolate trends from all those stories, which cities are worse, which government departments, and then direct public attention to specific problems in the system. The thinking is that officials will think twice before demanding a bribe.
It's a recurring nightmare for the government. Black money in foreign banks.
India is negotiating its relationship with corruption and how to phase it out. And it's doing it under the pressure of what Swati Ramanathan described to me as a double whammy: crazy fast urbanization and expectations from the rest of the world. Multinationals want to expand their operations in India, but sense that corruption may be just the way of things there.
I think it'll take time to fix it, but we're a young democracy. We are 60 years old, so give us, you know, another 40 years and we'll get there.
We'll get there. That's key for young Indians like Aditya Kumar.
To be very honest, till a few years ago, I was doing it. I have paid a bribe to the traffic cops. But now I'm not doing it anymore.
For The World, I'm Alex Galifant, Bangalore, India.
You can check out the top five Indian cities cited for bribe violations, according to users on the I Paid a Bribe website. And check out the video featuring I Paid a Bribe's 10 Commandments. That's all at theworld.org. The day's top news stories are next on PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Still ahead, a Mexican band from Guadalajara that used music to challenge local attitudes.
Many of the songs were about not exactly homosexuality, but about morality, about the behavior of the people in Guadalajara, who is very hypocritical.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, celebrating the selection of Dr. Dini Solnaun from the University of North Carolina as the 2011 Society for Women's Health Research Medtronic Prize recipient. More about her contribution to women's health and her work in gynecological pain at swhr.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. A devastating drought is gripping the Horn of Africa region and has put more than 10 million people at risk. There's been little rain for a second straight year in an area where the borders of Somalia, Ethiopia, and Kenya meet. That sent tens of thousands of refugees on long treks toward crowded camps in Kenya and Ethiopia. More than 1,000 arrive in those camps on foot each day. The BBC's Anne Mwathe is in the town of Dadaab in eastern Kenya near the border with Somalia. Anne, you've spent several days with drought refugees in the camps there on the border. These people, we understand, have walked for days across the desert to get aid. What shape are they in?
Most of them are malnourished. We've seen women who are too weak even to take care of their own children. We saw at one of the camps, I saw a woman who had a child who had died on her back, and she didn't know. She was still queuing to get registered at the refugee camp. And that's just one of the challenges that they have to face once they cross the border, because most of them cross with the notion that once they come in, they are going to get food aid, they are going to get shelter as soon as they get here, but it can take as long as 12 days to first get food once you've come into the refugee camps. Now, today I went to a town very close to the border of Kenya and Somalia. This is a border town. It's called Liboi. And along the way, we met women, we met children, we met men walking towards Dadaab refugee camp. Some of them told us that they've been walking for 40 days. Some of them have been working for more than that, and these were families who had very small children. One of the women gave birth yesterday night, and all she had taken was black tea, and that's all she had. And then she tied a piece of cloth around her waist, and she said, you know, she was too weak, so she did not even breastfeed that child.
And why does it take so long to get that food to those refugees once they arrive in those camps? I mean, 12 days, that's a long time.
The problem is overcrowding. I mean, there are 30,000 refugees who have arrived at the refugee camp and are living on the periphery. They do not even have proper shelter. We saw one who had just arrived and was making a very... The house that we saw was made of tree branches, and she didn't even have material to cover that house with. And she had just arrived. And whatever she had was some yellow containers of water that the refugees who have been here much longer had given her. Most of them are also depending on those who have been here much longer to give them food, to give them water, at least some form of help.
You know, aid groups, Anne, are comparing this drought with the one that hit the Horn of Africa in the early 1990s in the way you're describing, and I can see the comparison. What are people saying about what's going to happen this time?
You know, there's so much hope within these people that they believe once they get into the refugee camps that this is the promised land. But what I've seen and what the stories they're telling us, we had a story of a mother who left her child along the way because the child was too weak to walk, the child was sick, and she had other children that she had to cross the border with. And she decided to leave this child across on the other side of the border. Mm. And she was talking about how she still sees the eyes of this child staring at her and the guilt that she feels now that she's arrived here. Most of them are not even talking about the devastation that they are facing along the way. And what shocked me was the way they paced through their stories, their journey into the refugee camps in a very detached way. And I asked one of the doctors who said that is one of the signs of trauma. Mm. I mean, after you've given up everything that you had and now you've crossed up to this other side of the border and you find that actually what you were coming to is actually nothing, and you have to wait for another 12 days for you to, perhaps even longer, for you to get food aid.
You spoke of the security situation back in Somalia. Our listeners will remember that much of Somalia is controlled by the Islamist rebels known as Al-Shabaab, and they in fact banned aid groups from working in the territory they control back in 2009. But now they've reversed that decision. Is aid now getting to the areas under control by these insurgents?
I think it will take time for that to take effect, even for the aid agencies to organize themselves around this new decision that has been made by Al-Shabaab. It's not as easy as just waking up one day and deciding now they are going into Somalia, because even if they said they were going to Somalia now to give aid there, there are no structures. There is not one point where they can get people to come and collect this aid. And Also, there's also a little bit of skepticism because we talked to one of the new arrivals, the ones who were walking towards the refugee camp, and they were saying that they had been stopped by Al-Shabaab militia along the way, and they were being told to stay within Somalia, that it is better to die within their country, and to pray that the rains will come. So, yes, Al-Shabaab might have said that it's okay that aid agencies can go in, but on the ground, we are hearing mixed reactions to that announcement by the group.
The BBC's Anne Mwathe in the town of Dadaab on the Kenyan-Somali border. Thank you very much, Anne.
Thank you.
For today's GeoQuiz, where do you imagine this sound is coming from? Now, my turntable used to sound like that when the needle played out the last track, but that was actually data recorded by NASA's Cassini spacecraft. It's orbiting a planet we'd like you to name, where lightning is flashing in a tremendous storm that's encircling the planet's northern hemisphere. Scientists are calling it the Great Northern Storm.
This storm has wrapped around the planet over a period of several months. It started off as a small dot, and now it's wrapped around. So it's truly enormous.
It's apparently bigger than the entire surface area of the Earth. We have a picture at theworld.org. Scientists from the U.S., Britain, France, and Germany have been analyzing the latest images of the storm. One of them will tell us on which planet it lies in just a few minutes. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, they say, but technically, beauty is in the brain of the beholder. British researchers have found a specific area in the brain that lights up when we experience something beautiful. For the study, scientists put volunteers in a brain scanner. The participants listened to music and viewed paintings, and then they were asked to rate what they heard or saw on a scale from very beautiful to very ugly. One of the researchers who conducted the study was Samir Zeki. He's a professor of neuroaesthetics at University College London. He says when people looked at paintings they found beautiful, a specific part of the brain was activated.
It's a region in the front of the brain called the medial orbital frontal cortex. Equally, when they listen to musical excerpts which they experience as beautiful, again, there's activity in the very same part of the medial orbital frontal cortex. So in a sense, there seems to be sort of an abstract quality to the beauty, if you see what I mean, in the sense that the same part of the brain is active when one experiences beauty, regardless of whether the source of the beauty is musical or visual.
And did your subjects kind of have a consensus about beauty? I mean, did certain music and artwork activate that same part of the brain for the same people?
Well, not full consensus, but on the whole, I can tell you, for example, that the Johann Sebastian Bach violin concerto was preferred by most of them, though not all of them. It's qualified as very beautiful. The Ligeti violin concerto was qualified as ugly, actually, by most, but not all. For the painting, the Grand Obelisk by Ingres was qualified as being beautiful by most of them, and the Ugly Duchess by Matisse was qualified as being ugly by all, actually. But the important point is that each person had their own experience of beauty, which was not necessarily identical to the other person.
Tell us more, then, about this medial orbital frontal cortex. What do we know about it? Is it fair to call it kind of a pleasure spot?
Yes, I would say it's pleasure, satisfaction, reward center of the brain. It's a part of the emotional brain, which seems to be active in conditions of reward and pleasure. I think heavy concentrations there of a neurotransmitter called dopamine, which is often also described as the feel-good neurotransmitter. So there is a great dopaminergic activity in that part of the brain. There could, of course, be subdivisions of that area which deal with different kinds of reward, but certainly this area seems to be active when you experience something as beautiful, which incidentally a lot of people also describe as very pleasurable.
What clues did you have already that led you to examine this particular part of the brain as the possible beauty center, if we can call it that?
Well, we had done a study some years ago on beauty again, but only on visual beauty, which led to activity in this part of the brain. And what we want to do really is to ask the following question, which philosophers and humanists have been asking for millennia. What is common to all the things that we experience as beautiful? And there have been lots of debates about this and lots of arguments, but there's never been a satisfactory answer. And so we thought it was worthwhile asking the question in a neurobiological context. And we can say that what is common to all these pieces of music which people experience as beautiful and paintings which they experience as beautiful is that the experience has as a correlate activity in the medial orbital frontal cortex. Now, this, of course, does not say anything about the characteristics of the paintings or the musical excerpts which were qualified as beautiful. I mean, is it proportion? Is it harmony? Is it symmetry? Is it size? What is it? Nobody's come to a satisfactory conclusion. I mean, you can ask any philosopher or humanist what do different bits of music and different paintings and perhaps even moral beauty have in common, and they would be hard put to it to give an answer. But see, we can tell you an answer which does not rely on the characteristics of the objects or the musical excerpts, but relies on the characteristics of the brain.
Semir Zeki is a professor of neuroaesthetics at University College London. His new study on where beauty resides in the brain appears in the journal PLOS ONE. We'll put a link to the study at our website. Dr. Zeki, thanks very much for your time indeed.
Thank you.
Lightning flashes and thunder cracks make for a great show on a summer night. But the big storm we asked about in today's GeoQuiz has some space scientists on the edge of their seats. Andrew Ingersoll is an atmospheric scientist at the California Institute of Technology. So, Andy, you have your eye on something nicknamed the Giant Northern Storm. What exactly do you see, and where is the storm raging?
The storm is on Saturn in the Northern Hemisphere. Of course, Saturn is a giant planet, nine times bigger than Earth, and this storm has wrapped around the planet. It started off as a small dot, and now it's wrapped around. So it's truly enormous.
And when you say wrapped around, how many square miles are we talking about?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. the circumference of Saturn is nine times the circumference of Earth, and this storm is 9,000 miles wide in latitude. So it's a lot of square miles, a lot more than the entire surface area of the Earth.
Now, Saturn's very different from Earth and Jupiter, where storms and weather systems are very frequent. What's the predicted path of this storm on Saturn?
It's likely just to slowly run down. There have been six storms. The first one that was observed from Earth was in 1876. Six storms that wrapped around the planet of Saturn. Only six, which is quite amazing, considering that there are 1,000 thunderstorms at any one time on Earth. And here, there have only been six. On the other hand, although there are only six, they make up for it in size and intensity.
How hard is it to observe, you know, what's going on with this storm on Saturn, and especially the lightning? How do you capture that?
Well, the clouds from the storm can be observed from Earth, and amateur astronomers on Earth have been helping us keep track of the storm, because this Cassini spacecraft, which I work with, can't be reprogrammed immediately, and the amateurs can just go out in their backyards and watch the storm. So it's big and easy to see, but Cassini also has instruments that can, you might say, hear the storm, at least pick up the radio signals from the lightning. So we've been watching the storm with cameras, listening to it with the radio, and measuring its temperature in the infrared.
Well, as you say, the Cassini spacecraft is collecting that audio data. Let's hear that, because we have a recording. And we thought that dust storm in Phoenix was bad. Good thing you don't live on Saturn, you Phoenix people. So can lightning storms on Saturn sound even more menacing than this?
You know, you're listening to this sound, which sounds sort of like raindrops, I suppose, on a tin roof.
Yeah.
But each little burst that you hear is a separate lightning flash. This is not just one echoey flash. It's more than 10 flashes per second. In fact, the radio receiver can't count faster than that. So we have no idea how many lightning flashes per second there are. Really a lot of lightning.
Is this weather system unique to Saturn, or can you draw conclusions from it that would be useful to, you know, your studies of the atmosphere here on Earth?
Well, that's really one of the puzzles that we're trying to figure out, given that we only have a dozen or so planets with atmosphere in the solar system. It is unique to Saturn. Earth has maybe 1,000 thunderstorms going on at once at any one time, and Saturn's weather is totally different. You go for 20, 30 years, and there's no storm at all of this size, and then all of a sudden it erupts, lasts for months. Why should Saturn's weather be so intermittent? It's still a mystery.
Well, it is a beautiful mystery, and we've got the colorful photographs of storm on Saturn to prove it at theworld.org. Andrew Ingersoll with Caltech in Pasadena, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you who played our GeoQuiz texting game today. Here are today's winners.
I'm Alexandra from Orlando, Florida.
My name is Hans. I'm from Kirtland, Ohio.
Hi, my name is Atusa from Dallas. And the correct answer to today's GeoQuiz is Saturn.
Go ahead. Give it a try next time. Just text GeoQuiz, one word, to 69866. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Mexico and the U.S. signed a new agreement yesterday. The deal allows U.S. and Mexican commercial trucks to cross the border in either direction. That was a provision of the 1994 North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, but that provision has been on hold for years because of American concerns over jobs and safety. Mexico retaliated by imposing tariffs on a long list of U.S. products. The deal inked yesterday in Mexico City does away with the tariffs, but only when the U.S. actually starts letting Mexican trucks across the border. Hernan Rosenberg is senior correspondent for Fronteras, the Changing America desk in San Antonio, Texas. Hernan, sounds like Mexican officials are hedging their bets a bit, aren't they?
Yeah, I think they've been pretty skeptical in the past, given the history that they've had. I mean, essentially, they've been waiting for almost 2 decades for this thing to take place.
Let's talk about the job migrating issue that critics of the agreement have been talking about. Unions on the U.S. side have always been against this agreement. They say it'll take away jobs. Is that actually the case?
Yeah, that is their argument. The Teamsters president, Jim Hoffa, quickly issued a statement in reaction to the signed agreement saying that it will be bad for U.S. jobs. It will be bad for U.S. safety, even given the situation in Mexico right now with the violence. They're even tying that into this issue now.
You mentioned safety. Many in the U.S. say Mexican drivers in their trucks are not as safe as American ones. But does the U.S. have all the infrastructure in place to begin what's, you got to believe, is going to be a large-scale monitoring of these Mexican trucks and drivers? Safety reviews, driving tests, drug tests, can they do it?
Well, if you ask the Teamsters, they'll say no. If you ask Mexican officials, they'll say yes. They'll say that this has been used as an excuse in the past to try to keep them from being able to do what they do.
Hernan, give us a couple of checks on this job migrating issue. I mean, how much lower is the pay in Mexico for these truckers?
I don't know the exact number, but there is a contention by U.S. labor unions that Mexican truckers get paid much lower in that that reduces wages on the U.S. side, plus takes jobs away from the U.S. side. But the American Chamber of Commerce, which has pushed for Mexican trucks to be able to get through in compliance with NAFTA, has said that the cost of not allowing Mexican truckers into the United States has cost $150 per crossing, or an estimated $675 million a year.
Mm. So possibly jobs to be lost, but some money to be gained, perhaps.
Absolutely. That's no surprise coming from the American Chamber of Commerce, which wants the free flow of traffic.
Hernan Rosenberg, senior correspondent for Fronteras, the Changing America desk, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you, Marco.
Finally today, the Mexican state of Jalisco is known as the birthplace of mariachi music, but there's more to it than that, musically speaking. Reporter Beto Arcos tells us about a local band called El Personal and what its music says about its hometown, Jalisco's capital.
The story of El Personal takes place in the quintessential Mexican city, Guadalajara, where Mexican identity was forged centuries ago. But take a listen to this song called La Tapatía. Many consider it the city's unofficial anthem. The song talks about food and famous sights in Guadalajara. It's about a man who falls in love with a drag queen as they stroll the local streets.
La conocí en la central comprando un virote descomunal. Por la calzada yo me fui siguiendo sus pasos, me perdí. En San Juan de Dios la encontré y en el mercado me la ligué. La agarré de la cintura y le dije con dulzura, deme un besito siquiera, ándele, no sea ranchera, no sea ranchera.
It's a little unusual to hear popular Mexican tunes featuring gay characters, but El Personal's original drummer, Pedro Fernandez, and the main singer and songwriter, Julio Haro, were openly gay. Both died of AIDS in the early 90s. Alfredo Sanchez is one of the band's remaining founding members.
Many of the songs were about not exactly homosexuality, but about morality, about the behavior of the people in Guadalajara, who is very hypocritical.
Guadalajara is a city of contrasts, says journalist Rubén Martínez, who's written about El Personal. He says their songs capture this tension.
It is a city that is known for its machismo through the figure of the charro, the Mexican male with the spangled outfit, the rodeo, mariachi type figure on the one hand. On the other hand, it's known for its gay underground. And Julio Haro comes out right from the fault line between those two extremes. And he gives voice to that contradiction with sarcasm, with biting irony, and he erupts onto the pop music scene and gives voice to that very contradiction.
In the song No Te Hagas or Don't Fake It, Julio Haro poked fun at people who were afraid to admit their sexual orientation.
No te hagas, que a ti te está pasando lo mismo que a mí. No te hagas, que a ti también te gusta estar junto a mí.
Many people complain about tapatíos being sort of two-faced.
Diego Escobar is a young music promoter in Guadalajara. He says many tapatíos, as the people of Guadalajara are called, live a kind of a double life.
They frown upon some things and then have a few tequilas at night and then go about do the exact same things they were frowning upon in the morning, in mass.
You can hear those contradictions in the more introspective lyrics of El Personal. In the song called No Me Hallo or I Can't Find Myself, Julio Haro addressed his concern about not fitting in a traditional society, a feeling that resonates with many Mexicans today.
Me busqué en el directorio, me busqué en la enciclopedia, me busqué en el padrón electoral, me busqué en la filosofía oriental, no me hallo.
El Personal disbanded some years ago, but their songs are still embraced by their home city. At a recent tribute concert to El Personal in Guadalajara, Café Tacuba's lead singer Rubén Albarrán performed this song. He was accompanied by the surviving three original members, a few guest musicians, and a house full of tapatíos.
Ya no te voy a tocar.
El Personal's Alfredo Sanchez says he's been surprised how popular the band still is, especially among young people.
They still are touched by the songs. They still understand what they say. I think the songs are very relevant now in these days, in the 21st century.
Alfredo Sanchez says there's talk about doing more reunion concerts with the original surviving members. They'd like to continue celebrating El Personal's Legacy. For the World, I'm Beto Arcos, Guadalajara, Mexico.
Yo no quiero ser tu padre. Yo no quiero ser tu madre.
That's all for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We're back tomorrow with another spin of the world.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Plowshares Fund, investing in peace and security worldwide, plowshares.org, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and NASA, leading research on the Earth and its climate from the vantage point of space.
PRI, Public Radio International.